Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience and have a fantastic day.
Would you like 2023 to be tax-free? Hey, it's Lars. Then make plans to join David Moore for a free webinar Wednesday, March 29th at 10 a.m. Pacific time for the latest 1031 exchange news and updates. For those asking for the nitty-gritty of a 1031 exchange, this is your class to learn the basics of the 1031 exchange, what qualifies, and how to apply the process. In this webinar, you'll learn the lingo, a glossary of terms, what you should know about doing an exchange in 2023, the benefits and pitfalls, and flipping with a 1031 exchange. If you're an Oregon broker, this 1031 exchange class provides attendees with 1 hour of core real estate continuing education and the knowledge to identify and apply the 1031 exchange to client investment real estate transactions. Plus, anybody who signs up gets a copy of the slides and a link to view the session again. For more information and registration, go to 1031exchange.com. You've worked hard to earn your money. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it is truly a target-rich environment today. So I'm going to invite you into the show in a moment. Let me tell you what we're keeping an eye on, and then I'll tell you where I'm going to lead off. Because the idiots in Salem, in this case, there are plenty of idiots at the legislature in Olympia, but let me start with Salem. They have decided to revive a bill that was dead for a while that literally may make private armed security illegal in the state of Oregon. It may literally go after your neighborhood watch group and say, you can't do that. You can't walk around your neighborhood armed, even if you're carrying legally, to protect your own neighborhood. This is how extreme the Democrats, who control supermajorities in both houses of the legislature, they control the governor's office. They used to control the Secretary of State's office, but I'll get to that in just a moment. And they're going to literally make it illegal for you to engage in protecting your own neighborhood. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, here's what we're watching right now. There has been a shooting in Atlanta. The gunman is on the loose. He's on the run. We'll bring you updates as we get them. There is, sad to say, one person dead, three people wounded in that incident in Atlanta, Georgia. The resignation and possible criminal investigation of Shamia Fagan, who resigned in disgrace yesterday as Oregon Secretary of State. And yet much of the media is carrying water for her. They're trying to throw sympathy in her direction. They say, well, you know, she's a divorced mom and she wasn't making enough money to pay the bills. She had to engage in a little bit of graft on the side to be able to pay the bills. And now the question that should be the number one question, will there be a real criminal investigation? And if you say, Lars, you're trying to convict her before she's even been accused. No, I'm not. I'm just saying there should be a real criminal investigation. And what Governor Tina Kotek has proposed is not a real criminal investigation. And here's why. Kotek, when she learned of the graft, and I'd really like to know what she knew and when she forgot it about the graft and corruption, I believe, Shamia Fagan engaged in. She's handed off to the attorney general. You say, well, that sounds like a serious kind of job. Attorney general, she could bring charges. No, she can't. Other than election law violations, which are kind of chump change, they're nothing much. Can she bring a bribery accusation against Shamia Fagan? No. Can she bring an official misconduct allegation against Shamia Fagan? She can't do that either. How about RICO? Can she pursue a RICO case against Shamia Fagan and her friends in the weed business who bought their own personal Secretary of State? No, she can't. She can't bring any of those charges. So Tina Kotek is pulling a slick move, the kind of move you kind of expect from slick and sleazy Democrats who say, I know, I'll just tell the people we're going to have the attorney general investigate. That sounds really serious. Only not at the federal level, but at the state level, the attorney general of Oregon has no power of original criminal jurisdiction. That means she can't bring criminal charges. So Tina Kotek, who wants to protect her own party, the way Shamia Fagan has apparently decided to graft because of her own party, and I'll give you examples a little bit later on in the hour, she's going to protect her own party by saying, I'm going to throw the whole criminal investigation to somebody who can't accuse Shamia Fagan of committing crimes. And I don't know. I've been reading as much of the story coverage on this as I possibly can. Can you find anybody else in the media who's mentioning the governor is going to have somebody investigate the possible crimes of Shamia Fagan, and the person doing the criminal investigation can't bring any criminal accusations? I mean, it's like a contradiction in terms. In any case, next, a whistleblower, and this is brand new in the last few hours, a whistleblower now alleges that the FBI and the DOJ at the federal level, that's Joe Biden's FBI and his DOJ, headed up by the rather, corrupt Merrick Garland, are in possession of a document. I'm quoting from what James Comer, who's one of the members of the committee that's been investigating this, they're in possession of a document that describes a criminal scheme. This is criminal, involving then Vice President Joe Biden and a foreign national. Let's see, who should we guess? Ukraine, Moscow, Beijing. I think that's the place. Vice President Joe Biden and a foreign national relating to the exchange of money for policy decisions. If that is the case, you may be about to see Joe Biden brought down. If you thought Watergate was bad, this is bad on steroids. Watergate was one political party stealing information from another party, a burglary, some wiretapping. Yeah, all bad stuff and an attempted cover-up from the White House. What if we've got a president sitting in the Oval Office who took money from a foreign country in exchange for policy decisions when he was vice president? What do you do with somebody like that? I say you impeach them, but that's just my opinion. In Washington state, Governor Jay Inslee has called the legislature to a special session to do something about illegal drugs. By the way, that something is something the regular session of the legislature didn't get done in several months. So after several months of legislature, you're going to call them back to a special session to do the work they didn't get done over the last few months. And finally, the latest crazy and almost certainly unconstitutional new gun laws in Oregon, passed by lawmakers, even though a voter-approved anti-gun law has already been halted by a temporary restraining order. Why? Because it's unconstitutional. So the Democrats say, hey, let's just double down on unconstitutionality. It's popular right now. Let's pass another unconstitutional law and take the civil rights of American citizens who call themselves Oregonians. So, with all that as the context, all the things we're going to keep an eye on today, glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to take your calls as well. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, our friends like Kevin Starrett, who we're going to talk to later, from the Oregon Firearms Federation, they alert us that there is a bill brought back from the dead. This bill was dead in the legislature. It's House Bill 2572. All of a sudden, it's brought back from the dead like some kind of zombie legislation. It's going to the House Committee on Rules tomorrow, which doesn't have the same deadlines that all the other legislative committees have. And what's inside this bill? It is, as OFF points out, supported by the most extreme anti-gun organizations, League of Women Voters, Alliance for Gun Responsibility, Oregon Department of Justice. And promoters say it's not a gun bill, but check out what it does. The bill strips the rights of legally armed people to protect their own property. And leftists are saying, oh, we're going to go after paramilitary organizations, except that what they've defined a paramilitary organization as, three or more persons associating under a command structure for the purpose of functioning in public or training to function in public as combat, combat support, law enforcement, or security services. Your neighborhood watch group meets that definition. And in fact, the lawyer for the legislature, the legislative council, has said the definition of a private paramilitary organization is so broad, it could apply to a private security company. The security company has no exception under the law. It could also apply to your church security team. I'll get to Shamia Fagan and the Northwest Nonsense coming up next. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Disgraced ex-Secretary of State Shamia Fagan showers her with sympathy. Forgive me if I don't join in. Fagan acted like a junior league Hunter Biden, scoring graft and likely committing crimes in her office. After all, her main paycheck of $10,000 a month came not from the state of Oregon, but from the weed people at Lamoda. When her own political party illegally took $500,000 under a false name from the FTX cryptocurrency scam, she assigned the alleged investigation of that crime to a former Democrat Party official. The state-affiliated media, like Oregon Public Broadcasting, calls this criminal activity a consulting flap. So what crimes do I think Fagan committed? And remember, I'm not a prosecutor, I'm not a lawyer. I think she committed bribery. I think she committed official misconduct, theft by deception, and RICO. When the owners of Lamoda, who bought and paid for Fagan's services, got the news of her resignation live on a Coin TV news camera, one of them kept repeating over and over, "We've done nothing wrong. There's nothing for anyone to find. I don't know why we're being scrutinized." Oh, poor potheads. As Shakespeare would say, "Methinks the lady doth protest too much." By the way, Rosa Caceres and Aaron Mitchell, the owners of Lamoda, have failed to meet their financial obligations. That's a fancy way of saying they apparently owe tax liens totaling $7 million. I don't know if that includes the $600,000 in weed fees that they haven't yet paid to the OLCC. But then again, they bought some favors. They bought some special access to the OLCC through the monies that they paid to Shamia Fagan. And if Shamia Fagan wants to comment on that, she's always welcome to come on this show and answer all the questions she wants. I figure she'll be about as talkative as Joe Biden is usually. Unfortunately, Governor Tina Kotek has assigned the criminal investigation of Fagan to Democrat apparatchik and AG Ellen Rosenblum, who has no power whatsoever to bring criminal charges other than election law charges. It surely sounds to me like the fix is in. And Mel Emberlin writes in, "Lars, so will Tina Kotek demand her replacement for Fagan pledge not to run as an incumbent like Kate Brown did for Dennis Richardson's replacement? On another note, Oregon's decriminalization of hard drugs is working so well now that Washington State is taking it up." Signed, Mel. Well, the fact is, you're not allowed to offer something of value in exchange for either running for office or not running for office. That would be another election law violation. Unfortunately, the person in charge of keeping an eye out for election law violations, that would be Shamia Fagan. And she wasn't doing exactly a bang-up job of that. She was too busy with her weed duties. Our question of the day, and this one's a longish one from Beth. Beth wrote into me, apparently she's a mom, and she heard me talking about the drag show that's going to go on at Atkinson Elementary School. Now, she says it's been canceled. I've called the school. They haven't told us. But I said it was age inappropriate to put drag queens in full dress in front of a bunch of kids no older than 11 years. Well, she wrote to me, and I want to put her concern out in front of you because I like naysayers. She said, "I heard you discussing Atkinson Elementary's GSA, that's Gay Straight Alliance Pride Fest, on your show yesterday. As a parent of a child of that school, I implore you to please use caution about how you talk about this topic. There's a real chance of bringing harm or violence into this community, and I hope you understand and take your responsibility seriously as a public voice to your base. I'm much more scared of some right-wing nut bringing a gun into school and shooting it up because of this topic than I am of a person in costume reading a book to my kids. Every parent I've talked to about this is saddened and upset that the gay festival had to be canceled because of the fear-mongering that's taking place around this issue now. This is not a compulsory activity for school children. It was a fundraised event supporting the GSA Club, taking place after school hours for anyone who wanted to attend. No one is forcing any child to be exposed to nail painting and story time, God forbid. That was to be for those who chose to support these children who identify as LGBTQ or allies of them. Don't put a target on these children. Thank you, Beth." And I wrote back to Beth and I said, "Beth, there are things that are age appropriate for kids. There are things that are not age appropriate for kids." And I tried to give her a few examples. I don't think that drag queens dressed up pretending to be women and oftentimes in scanty clothes showing up in front of 10, 9, 8, or 7 or 6-year-olds is age appropriate. Just my point of view. If anybody wants to contest that, I did invite her on as a naysayer. She has declined to take that opportunity. And now today's Daily Grill.
insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Better Basements and Waterproofing. Water in your crawl space or basement? Call Better Basements and Waterproofing. Don't stop,
Well, they always say that the only certainties in life are death and taxes, and as it turns out, Oregon has figured out how to combine death and taxes. In many states, getting a death certificate so that you can take care of the business of somebody who's just passed away costs about $6. In Oregon, our friends at Oregon Catalyst point out it's four times that much, $25 to get a piece of paper from the state certifying that you've died. Whether living or dying, Oregon government costs you more. As they put it, it's just tragic that this costly and time-consuming paperwork at the point of someone's death comes at the single worst possible time for families. Couldn't government just pick a little more of the cost up on this one expense? Well, they've now created a legislative task force to modernize, upgrade, and make death certificates more accessible. Doesn't sound like it'll make them any cheaper, but maybe the state will make a few more money on the dead on their way into the ground. Our best email of the day. I don't usually read emails from my friend Josh, but he was on yesterday talking about this Shamia Fagan and the possibilities of her crimes. I noticed that most of the media is not taking any time to talk about her possible crimes. They merely say, well, she wasn't making enough money and she's a mom of three and she's divorced and you should feel sorry for her. I don't share that. Josh Marquis, former DA, writes in, Lars, I say this as a longtime Democrat, active member of the Democrat Party, superdelegate to the Democrat National Convention, elected member of my county's Democratic Central Committee. I still haven't changed sides. But the sheer corruption on display surrounding the FTX contribution, the illegal activities of soon-to-be former Secretary of State Shamia Fagan, the kabuki leadership of new Governor Tina Kotek, and the non-action of the most politicized AG in history, Ellen Rosenblum, is breathtaking. The greed of former Governor Kitzhaber's dazzling companion, he's talking about Sylvia Hayes, 8 years ago, that led to his forced resignation, pales by comparison. The FTX scandal is sending a lot of people to prison, and the Democratic Party of Oregon can't return their dirty $500,000 because they already spent it. The overt politicization of the Office of Secretary of State, which has until Kate Brown's tenure been covered in glory, clearly the office needs to be made nonpartisan. A special prosecutor and a referral to the U.S. attorney is a must, but not limited to deliberate interference with the cannabis audit by Shamia Fagan, the firing of former Deputy Secretary of State, accepting money as a no-show consultant for the pot empire, and trying to steer state policy toward Fagan's true masters, the owners of LaModa, signed Josh Marquis, former DA. We'll talk to the folks who actually broke that story at Willamette Week, coming up next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Shamia Fagan has resigned.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
3 minutes ago.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So if you guys need to capture, so it'd take like a couple minutes to just like kind of get your breath and get your thoughts.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Yes, that's one of the young. That is one person who is one of the owners of LaModa, the weed outfit that is apparently $7 million in debt to the tax man, both in Salem and in Washington, D.C. And now they've lost one of their biggest assets because they managed to buy themselves their very own Secretary of State in Shamia Fagan, who's now been forced to resign her job. And I want to give full and lavish credit to the outfit that did it and reintroduce to you our friend Nigel Jake, was the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for Willamette Week. Sophie Peel led the pack. And, of course, there were other people involved in the team as well, Nigel and Aaron Mesh. I can't give you enough plaudits and props and kudos, Nigel, for doing this again. I mean, you did it with Goldschmidt. You've done it with so many other figures. And now it appears that Willamette Week may have been the one that really took down Shamia Fagan as Secretary of State. Welcome back, by the way, buddy.
Thanks for having me on. And yes, I want to make sure everybody understands that Sophie Peel, who's a fine young reporter, really led the way on this story. I helped her, but it's Sophie who really did the heavy lifting. And there's no doubt. There's no doubt that without Sophie Peel's work, that Shamia Fagan would not have resigned, because it was Sophie who got the tip last Thursday that said, hey, Shamia Fagan is working for this outfit, LaModa, that gave her $45,000 for her campaign. And Sophie and I talked about it, and I said, highly unlikely to be true, because Fagan is a really ambitious, really smart, Secretary of State. She's a lawyer. She knows she couldn't do that. She wants to be U.S. Senator or governor. She's got a good chance to be either. She wouldn't risk her career on such a stupid decision, but in fact, she did.
Well, I mean, think about this, Nigel. If you look at spy operations, what's one of the best ways to recruit human assets in another country, whether we're doing it or some other country? They look for people who've got financial problems, and they say, yep, we can get those people compromised. You think it's fair to say, without knowing what's inside her head, that the thing that drove her to do this was financial desperation?
Yeah, we reported on Sunday some of the details of a divorce filing that she made just as she was running for Secretary of State. They showed that she was spending more money than she was making, and she had personal debts of about $135,000. And in that financial situation, with her having two young children and being the sole income earner in her family, would not have gotten better since she took office. So I think, yes, it is indeed her financial vulnerability that led her to make this otherwise totally inexplicable decision. I spoke to somebody that you know well, former Secretary of State Bev Clarno, the last Republican to hold the office on Monday, and I said, what does this look like to you, Secretary Clarno? And she said, it's very clear. It's influence peddling. She sold the authority, the good name of the office that is responsible for elections, responsible for audits, responsible for the corporation division. So really, Shamia Fagan was the state's chief integrity officer. And as you pointed out at the top of your piece here, Lamota was in desperate need of some credibility because they owe more than $7 million in taxes to the state of Oregon and to the IRS, and they have been sued 30 times in circuit court. Many of those lawsuits were failing to pay their obligations. So, you know, by hiring somebody like Fagan, who is the state's chief integrity officer, in essence, they were really buying some influence.
And you've also described how Shamia Fagan told the OLCC, which was being audited by Shamia Fagan, because that's her job as secretary, or was her job, Secretary of State, you need to sit down with Rosa Caceres, who's politically active, one of the owners of Lamota, along with Ms. Mitchell, and you need to listen to her complaints. And she literally told the OLCC, it's quoted in a transcript, she said, you need to stop regulating our business so much. Go after the illegal weed operations, which, by the way, it's a criminal matter. You should have the Oregon State Police or other police go after it. But she was literally saying, stop regulating us. And she got that access, you believe, because she was putting $10,000 a month into Shamia Fagan's pocket.
Well, Fagan told us, yes, Fagan told us that she didn't know the Lamota principals until she ran for office, that she became personal friends with them, that she accepted $45,000 in campaign contributions from them. The records from the audit make it very clear that well before the audit started, Fagan said, look, you need to listen to what Rosa Caceres has to say. She's got a lot of complaints about this agency. Halfway through the audit, they meet to see how it's going. Fagan's only input, again, is make sure this audit reflects the concerns of Rosa Caceres. So it is 100% clear that she influenced the people who were doing the audit to listen to Rosa Caceres, who, as we've discussed, runs a deeply troubled company that has not fulfilled its legal obligations. So, you know, this is a very important state function, auditing state agencies to make sure they're doing their jobs properly, and it should be done for the interests of all Oregonians, not for the interests of a very troubled cannabis company.
Okay. Now, Nigel, I want to get into an area that I think is going to be avoided like the plague by the mainstream media. So far, they are. I think that crimes were committed, and I've named them. Bribery, official misconduct, theft by deception. Somebody says, I'll be your Secretary of State. I'll give my full energies to that job, and then sells her services to a private company on the side. And then, of course, we got the influence peddling, the pay for play. But theft by deception, to say I'll be your Secretary of State, then ignores her own job and instead works on the side for a greater amount of money. Now, the Governor Kotek, has said, I'm going to hand this to the Attorney General. Now, Attorney General sounds fancy. But as I understand it from my friend Josh Marquis, the former prosecutor, the AG can bring election law criminal violations, does not have original criminal jurisdiction to bring any charges on any of the crimes that may have been committed.
Is this Tina Kotek trying to take possible crimes committed by Shamia Fagan and bury them by appearing to hand them off to somebody important with a title like attorney general, knowing the attorney general can't bring criminal charges?
I think it would be premature to say that. I think actually Kotek has acted pretty aggressively to hold Fagan accountable. I think the criminal charges, I'm not a criminal lawyer, I'm not a criminal law expert. If there are crimes committed here, those would be mostly the purview of the Marion County District Attorney, who does not report to Tina Kotek and who can open a criminal investigation or ask police to open a criminal investigation at any time. So I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that this story is over yet, and I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that just because the DOJ has been asked to review the circumstances of the audit, that's the only review that's going to happen.
By the way, in the next segment, Nigel, I'm going to talk to a gentleman about reminding people of Val Hoyle. Val Hoyle took a chunk of money from LaMotta. Val Hoyle apparently steered $500,000 in taxpayer money to a group run by Rosa Caceres. And there may be more corruption going on. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think there are a lot of things still on the table. Sophie Peel wrote an excellent couple of stories about that when Val Hoyle was Boley commissioner. Boley awarded this very questionable $550,000 grant to this group that was allegedly going to do an apprenticeship program for the cannabis industry. Still remain unanswered questions about that. There are a ton of unanswered questions here, and we're still working pretty aggressively on some of those.
I just think that Oregon's got, we're up to here with corruption. You had Kitzhaber go out, thanks to you and your reporting, because of corruption of his girlfriend. Then he's replaced by Kate Brown, who staffs her office with a bunch of people who have connections to state suppliers, and that's corruption. And then you got Val Hoyle, and now you got Shamia Fagan. We got corruption to beat the band. That's Nigel Jaquas from W Week. The story originated by and the bring down of Secretary of State Shamia Fagan because of Sophie Peel's reporting. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your calls and we'll talk about Val Hoyle next. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Big news yesterday, the resignation of Shamia Fagan as Secretary of State because of corruption. Now, I've seen various media reports that call this a scandal. There are others that say it's a flap. I think it's more than that. I think it's actually criminal activity. But I don't think that the scandal stops there. I think it goes on to people like Val Hoyle. So I thought we'd talk with Ben Peterson, who's with the National Republican Congressional Committee, who knows all about this. Ben, welcome back to the program, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thanks for having me, Lars. This really is an incredible story of power, money, and corruption in Oregon Democrat circles.
Well, and the funny thing is, I'm not seeing much national coverage at all. Now, maybe it'll take a time to percolate out, but when you've got major league Democrat figures in office, elected in office in a very blue state, you'd think that when they start to fall to scandal, you'd say, well, there's a problem there. But the mainstream media nationally may say, oh, we're not interested in telling that story. Would you mind reminding folks of what was going on between Val Hoyle, then Boley chief, and LaMotta, the weed outfit, a big marijuana retailer, and the CEO of that company, Rosa Caceres?
Sure. Well, Val Hoyle, now Congresswoman Val Hoyle, took over $26,000 in campaign cash from the CEO of LaMotta and her husband. And then Hoyle turned around and backed giving $550,000 in a taxpayer-funded grant to a nonprofit started by that LaMotta CEO. It really smacks of corruption and pay to play. This is something that Willamette Week has also uncovered. But as Commissioner Boley, Val Hoyle backed giving over $500,000 to this nonprofit for a marijuana apprenticeship program. And Hoyle was backing this program even though the nonprofit started by LaMotta had no track record of job training, had no track record of doing any work at all, and proposed to train just four people.
They were going to train four people for $550,000, like $100,500 per trained employee, $150,000?
Exactly right. And the Oregon Apprenticeship Council was very skeptical of this at the time because the executive director of that nonprofit was going to make a salary of $97,000. And the program didn't have industry support besides LaMotta. But Val Hoyle vouched for this program, and it got approved. And now Val Hoyle's successor at the Bureau of Labor is trying to revoke the money after the news broke. It turns out the apprenticeship wasn't even legally possible.
No, it wasn't possible. Why? Explain that, please.
The funds for this apprenticeship are federal funds, and because marijuana is illegal at the federal level, they can't be used for this type of program in the first place.
Somebody must have missed that detail, right? And because the illegal nature of pot at the federal level has been discussed ad infinitum in marijuana legal states like Washington and Oregon, they're always talking about how can't we change the law? And I said, yeah, get enough votes in the House of Representatives. And the last time I checked with a member of Congress, he said, yeah, they got about two-thirds of the votes they need. They need 218. They were at somewhere around 160. I don't know. They've actually moved the marker on Capitol Hill. You may have a better measure of that. But you know, when people say, well, marijuana is really popular. Great. Do you have 218 votes on Capitol Hill? No. Well, then it's not very popular, because if something is really popular, the people's representatives tend to get behind it.
Well, that's the real question is, did Val Hoyle know whether this program was not legally possible? Oregon really deserves the truth from Val Hoyle. They need to hear from her. Was this a quid pro quo between her getting all this campaign money and giving all this taxpayer money to the nonprofit? You know, Val Hoyle needs to face an independent investigation to find out what she knew and if any improper behavior occurred, because this sure looks shady.
I mean, because, Ben, 97 grand for the CEO of the nonprofit. Who was going to be the CEO, or who is the CEO? Do you know?
I don't have
because
her
I
name
don't know.
Right at my fingertips here.
Okay.
But it was an associate of LaModa CEO Rosa Cazares.
So, in other words, she was finding ways to put money in the pockets of a friend. And what I'm trying to imagine, if somebody came to me, Ben, look, I've got my hands full with two talk shows and commentaries and everything else. But if somebody said, hey, Lars, how would you like to be the CEO of a training organization that's only going to train four people over the next few months? I think, well, that sounds like a no-show job. CEO of an organization training four people to work in the marijuana retail business? I mean, how hard could it be for almost 100 grand for that kind of job? Doesn't even sound like the numbers were right.
Exactly. Well, and zooming out here, Val Hoyle is one of the House Democrats being targeted by the National Republican Congressional Committee. She's a freshman member of Congress in a very weak position, especially with these revelations about her coming to light. And so Republicans have a real opportunity to flip the seat in 2024. It starts with holding her accountable for this scandal.
And Ben, I hope you're aware, because I've been dogging it since the beginning, since last fall. But when FTX, a big cryptocurrency scam, went under, and we found out the Democrat Party of Oregon had taken $500,000, and we said, give it back. And they said, we'll give it to charity. No, you don't get to give it to your friends. Give it back to the people who had money in it. There were people, regular, you know, average people, waiters and waitresses and other people who'd bought crypto, and they got all their money taken away. And you, the Democrats, have $500,000 of it. Give it back. And they won't give it back. And in fact, one of the things Shamia Fagan did before she lost her job yesterday was she assigned somebody to investigate it. You know, she assigned the director of elections, who is the former high official in the Democrat Party of Oregon. So in other words, you're going to have a former top Democrat Party official investigating whether the Democrat Party should give back $500,000 in stolen money. I mean, the graft and corruption, it runs thick. Ben Peterson from the National Republican Congressional Committee. I'd be glad to talk to the Democrats, too, by the way. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world.
go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest. Now, we're glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls. It sounds as though Republicans may have staged a walkout at the Oregon legislature, what a lot of us have been hoping for, since Republicans effectively have almost no say in what goes on in the state capitol because all of the statewide elected offices are held by Democrats and majorities, large majorities, in both houses of the legislature are held by Republicans. They're left with one option. If you don't want something to pass, you walk out the door. I thought I'd talk about that and about a couple of rather significant bills with our friend Kevin Starrett, who's executive director of the Oregon Firearms Federation, that stands up for Second Amendment rights and also Article 1, Section 27 rights under the state constitution. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. What a day, huh?
Yeah, what a day to follow up Shamia Fagan's resignation and now more games being played. But is there a walkout at the state capitol right now that's going to shut down some of this dangerous legislation?
Well, it shut it down for today. They adjourned until tomorrow, and the Republicans are saying that the reason they walked out is because the Democrats are breaking the law, and they are. They're openly breaking the law, which requires that bills meet certain qualifications, and the bills do not. And when they were confronted with this, they said, Rob Wagner, the Senate president said, tough, we're going to do what we want. So the Senate Republicans finally said, we've had enough. I mean, I wish the House Republicans would do the same thing. House Republicans continue to roll over, but the Senate Republicans said, look, you guys are breaking the law and we're not going to stand for it. So Tim Knope, who's the Senate Senate Republican leader, as usual, stayed there on the floor. But some of them were excused and some of them walked out, so they didn't have a quorum. So they had a shutdown till tomorrow. And what happens tomorrow is anyone's guess.
I mean, because it was pointed out to us yesterday by another member that they've got 50 days left in the session. So unless they walk out for 50 days and unless the governor calls a special session, tell my audience about the bills that they're saying do not meet the law and shouldn't be considered.
Well, virtually all of them, because their complaint is that Oregon statute says that bills and the summaries, et cetera, must be plainly written and easy to understand based on certain rules. And these things do not. They have to be there has to be a certain readability to them, so a person of average intelligence could easily understand them. And as they've discovered, in most cases, these bills would require someone with a postgraduate degree to understand. And in fact, most of the times, the people who wrote them don't understand them. Sometimes they clearly cannot be understood. And so these bills, as drafted, do not meet the required rules, and they pointed this out over and over, as they have in the House today. You know, there were attempts to make the same point today, and the people in charge just said, tough, we're going to do what we want. And so it's not necessarily really controversial bills. It's virtually all the bills that are written in a way that the average person could never figure out what they mean.
And by the way, to back up Kevin on this, and Kevin will tell me if I'm wrong, but a piece of legislation that's aimed at gender reaffirming care is the way they call it. That's the sponsors. But it would back up abortions for 10-year-olds and gender surgery and hormone treatment for underage children. And when this was brought up at a committee hearing, the sponsors of the bill literally gasped out loud when one of the legislature's lawyers was asked, would this authorize an abortion for a 10-year-old girl? And the lawyer said, yes, it would. And even the sponsors of the bill were surprised. So when you say people wouldn't understand the bills, the folks who are writing the bills don't understand the bills. But I do want you to spend a couple of minutes talking about House Bill 2005, and let's get to the militia bill as well, if you don't mind.
Okay, so 2005 is the first major anti-gun bill to pass through the House at this point. And what it does is it strips the rights from 18 to 20-year-olds to own firearms. It says people with concealed handgun licenses will have far more limitations on where they can go, in spite of the fact that they've never done anything wrong. And here's the thing that most people don't understand. It bans most modern rifles. And the reason it does that is because one part of an AR-style rifle has always been the regulated part. They wanted to ban the unserialized versions of those, what they mistakenly call ghost guns. But because they don't know what they're doing, they changed the definition to only apply to the part that's never been regulated. and require that that part have a serial number, which means all the guns, the hundreds of thousands of AR-style firearms in this state will become contraband when the Senate passes this bill. Because
which means,
the idiots do not know what they're doing.
Yeah, which means people who own a perfectly legal gun and think, well, I'm grandfathered in. I bought the gun legally. They changed the law. I can't buy another one, but I can own this one. They own a gun that under this law, because they said, if you have a gun that doesn't have a serial number on it, that's not a ghost gun, you know, so-called, I don't like the term either, but it doesn't have, say the barrel doesn't have a serial, never has. Probably never will. The ATF doesn't require it, that gun is illegal to possess. It turns hundreds of thousands of Oregonians into criminals.
Yeah, and ironically, the part they thought they were regulating is completely unregulated. So a perfectly standard part or rifle, which could have been brought into this state by any distributor, now will no longer legally be able to do that. And as you know, distributors have already stopped sending virtually any kind of magazines into this state because of Measure 114. Because Measure 114 says no magazines over 10 rounds or no magazine that could be over 10 rounds. So the distributors are saying, well, these things could be modified. We're not sending any more into the state. And when this passes, or maybe even before that, they'll say, my God, they've redefined what a firearm is. Our firearms don't meet those specifications. We can't send them into the state because it'll be illegal.
And when they talk about magazine, this could affect shotguns too, couldn't it? Because aren't some shotguns, you take the plug out, they're capable of holding enough rounds that you say, well, that shotgun is illegal and it's not an AR.
Well, sure. Sure. You know, 348, the Measure 114 that we have on hold at the moment banned anything that held more than 10 rounds. But most shotguns will hold more than 10 rounds because there are shortened shells called mini shells. So the whole shotgun will become illegal, not just the ones they can no longer buy, but the ones that people already own. It'll be illegal to take those out of your house. So all the trap and skeet shooters are going to be out of luck. So that's another bill. But in this case, 2005, it was really ironic to listen to people like Paul Evans say that a 20-year-old should not be allowed to have a rifle that he may have built himself because his brain isn't developed, but a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old can go be sexually mutilated without their parents' knowledge or permission. It's bizarre, ironic, and it's terrifying what's going on in this state.
Less than a minute. House Bill 2572 effectively makes private security, neighborhood watch, and groups like that illegal as organized militia?
Yeah, what they did is they defined paramilitary groups as people under a command structure. So what they specifically left out was Antifa and BLM, and they specifically mentioned who they were going after were Proud Boys and Three Percenters. And even the ACLU opposes this bill because it's blatantly unconstitutional. But anybody who's protecting their property and is armed can now be considered in a paramilitary organization and can be charged with a crime. And anybody who knows what they're doing can now be dragged in front of the attorney general and grilled and basically treated like a criminal.
Unbelievable. Kevin, keep up the fight. Thanks for it. The Oregon Firearms Federation, support them. They're a great organization. I've been affiliated with them for a long, long time. And Kevin, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Glad to have you on. That's Kevin Starr from the Oregon Firearms Federation. Coming up in a moment, I want you to consider something is being done somewhere else because it's a great idea for the Pacific Northwest. Should kids who sell dangerous drugs to another kid who dies be charged with murder? We'll get to that in a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails. I want you to consider a question. I want you to think about it seriously, and I'll give you an actual example where this is being done. In too many places in America, illegal drugs are killing people right and left. I think you've probably heard the numbers that we've talked about on this show, and most of the media have talked about, that in America this calendar year, we're likely to see the deaths of more than 100,000 Americans. About 70,000 of those will die from fentanyl overdose. Now, I'd agree with you if you said, well, should those people be taking illegal drugs, which in most cases are party drugs? In other words, they're out to have a good time. No, they shouldn't be taking them. There's a reason they're illegal. They're hugely dangerous. I mean, heroin is bad enough. Methamphetamine is bad enough. Cocaine is bad enough. But fentanyl puts them all to shame. Fentanyl is so dangerous, I've literally seen videos of police officers who've been overcome simply because either their skin touched some fentanyl, a tiny amount of powder, or they inhaled some fentanyl as they were searching a suspect car or a house, and they're overcome and they overdose, and if there isn't somebody there to help them right now, they end up dead. This is the kind of drug that's being taken. And why? Because fentanyl, made in China, And Joe Biden says nothing about it to his Chi-Com buddies because he's thoroughly bought off by Beijing. They send it to Mexico. Mexico then ships it north. It comes across our border. And what do the druggies do? Well, fentanyl's a lot more convenient than heroin. Heroin takes up some space. Fentanyl, I mean, you can pack enough fentanyl into a very, very small package to kill an entire community. In fact, I've seen times where enough fentanyl has been seized by the police in a state that if properly distributed or wrongfully and criminally distributed, could kill everybody in the state. It's that dangerous. And what do the druggies do? Well, they dilute it to some extent, and they make fake OxyContin, oxycodone, other kinds of party drugs. Why? Because you get the base material, you mix it with a bunch of the other stuff, and you end up with a lot of drugs. The problem, if you want to view it as a problem, is that the folks who make illicit drugs are not as careful as the pharmaceutical companies. If you get a pill from your doctor and your doctor says, this is 50 milligrams of something, he or she is giving you that dose because that's exactly the right dose for whatever ails you that he believes you should take that prescription medicine for. Do you think these drug guys and gals are making it up that carefully? So if they happen to get a little too much fentanyl in some pills and one of your children takes that pill thinking, I'm at a party, I'm going to have a good time. Again, I don't think it's proper behavior for them. They take the pill, they end up overdosing. And again, if their friends don't get them to help very, very soon, they end up dead. So put all of that in the background and consider this. If a teenage kid ends up selling one of these pills to somebody else's child or somebody else's adult. But in this case, I'm going to give you a real example involving children selling dangerous drugs to children. Should the person who sold the drugs be charged with a crime? I'm going to answer yes. I think they should be. I think there should be some consequences. Consider this. Out of Hays County, Texas, a teenager is now facing a murder charge, not manslaughter, not negligent homicide, murder in the fentanyl poisoning death of a Lehman High School student. April the 11th, not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, Hays County Sheriff's deputies say they were dispatched to a home. And what do they find? They found a 15-year-old high school student unresponsive, unconscious on the floor. Deputies say the preliminary cause of death is an accidental overdose of fentanyl, what I just described to you. The Mexican drug cartels are making billions of dollars selling these drugs into America. And China, because China won't stop the outflow of fentanyl into Mexico, where it's then transshipped into the United States, Joe Biden won't bring it up with his Chinese friends. Why, that might put the income of the Biden crime family in danger. So he's not going to say boo to Chairman Xi about what's going on there. So the drugs leave China, they go to Mexico, the Chinese make money, the Mexican drug cartels make money. At some level, the Biden crime family makes money, and the drugs come into your community and they kill your kids and adults as well. But I'm saying to you, as a parent, if somebody sold your son or daughter some of these pills, promising that they would be, oh, good, high, you're going to have a party time. In the investigation, the deputies, sheriff's deputies in Texas said they identified the person believed to have sold the fentanyl to the juvenile as an 18-year-old by the name of Jaquel Deshaun Ray. Ray was arrested the same day that the 15-year-old died, so at least they got on it quickly, and charged with delivery of a controlled substance, a second-degree felony. And then on the 1st of May, 2 days ago, they upped the charges to delivery of a controlled substance and murder, a first-degree felony. I think doing something like this would actually begin to bring some reality to all of this. Now, are all these kids going to understand, that's one of the risks I take if I decide to go out and traffic in these drugs? And if you tell me, Lars, you understand, that's only the final person who sold the drug. Yeah, it may have passed through a dozen hands before that. It leaves the Chinese factory. It comes all the way to Mexico. It goes into somebody else's hands. It's brought into America. Everybody's making money every step of the game. And when it finally arrives in America and then is turned into pills by somebody else who makes money and then it's sold to a major league dealer who then parcels out various amounts of these pills to lower level dealers. And it finally ends up at the street dealer who sells your kid half a dozen pills or one or two pills, and your child, thinking we're going to get high on Friday or Saturday night, ends up taking these pills and dying. Do you want somebody charged with that crime? Do you believe that it's murder? I believe it is. Because you're selling something that you know or should know has the great likelihood of killing somebody. And if you do that, I mean, if you put something, chemicals in somebody's drink, and you knew if the person drinks that drink, they are very likely to die. In this case, I think this kid is guilty, this 18-year-old, so technically he's an adult. But he sold it to somebody's 15-year-old kid, and he's now charged with murder. A lot of states won't do it, and for the life of me, I don't understand why. Why not say, listen, if you're going to sell drugs to my kid and you kill a kid or an adult, should you be charged with murder? I believe the answer to that is yes. Now, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. We promised over a quarter century ago that naysayers would always go to the head of the line. I'd love to have somebody tell me, no, he should only be delivered with, he should only be charged with delivery of a controlled substance. He shouldn't be charged with murder. Why? He didn't know if the kid was going to die or not. I guess in some of the numbers I've seen from the DEA and other drug enforcement agencies, state and local, they'll tell you that sometimes 4 pills in 10 will carry a deadly dose. And of course, it also depends on how, you know, the size of the dose and the size of the person that's taking it. If it's your 115-pound daughter, might just kill her. Maybe if it's a 250-pound high school linebacker, maybe he won't die. Maybe he'll live long enough for his friends to load him in the car and take him down and do a screech and thump, is what the cops call it. Push him out of the door of the car at the hospital emergency room. Maybe he'll live. But all of that is just rolling the dice. And they're rolling the dice with your kids. And if they do that and they kill your child, should somebody be charged with a crime? And in this case, I think the crime is murder. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can answer our Twitter poll. You'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. I want to bring something up in front of you, and that has to do with the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, as you know, there's been a lot of reporting in the last couple of months. Some of it has focused on the activities of Clarence Thomas and others, and some of the special, I guess, advantages that some Supreme Court justices have apparently enjoyed. I thought I'd talk about that with Tom Gipping, who's deputy director of the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I'll admit that Clarence Thomas has always been one of my favorites. I've never met the man in person. I have met his wife. She interviewed me once for a project she was working on. And that couple seems to have been under attack literally for the last couple of years. What exactly is going on here? And what do you think the left may have to do with all of these new stories about the Supreme Court and their activities, some of which I don't like either? Because I've seen them taking some nice favors from very wealthy friends, and I worry about that compromise in the court. What should we make of all this?
Well, this is an organized campaign by the left, and it has really three parts. They've been working to encourage people to look at Supreme Court decisions in political terms, so that Supreme Court decisions that people don't like, might be the Dobbs decision or something, that they're necessarily partisan or unethical in some way. The second step is to attack the Supreme Court, this majority, or individual justices like Clarence Thomas, for being unethical or partisan or something like that. And then the third step is to introduce legislation, and there are three bills introduced by Democrats, to create a way for citizens to file all sorts of complaints against justices that they don't like. That's the three-part plan. You're talking about part of that. I think the sincerity of this so-called concern about ethics is really in doubt, because the left only targets conservative justices. There have been plenty of instances by liberal justices that are comparable, and the left never says anything about them. So unless they're willing to apply this concern across the board, I think we really have to look more closely at what they're after.
See, and I agree with you on that. The laws and the rules should apply to everybody or nobody. And if you only want to apply them to some and use them as a political tool to gain advantage for your side, I can't back that up. But it does make me wonder. I know that Clarence Thomas has been reported, had a very good friend in Harlan Crow, the son of Trammell Crow, big real estate guy now long since passed, and the guy has billions of dollars. And he invites Clarence Thomas to go on vacations, fly in his plane, go to his fancy houses, various places. And, of course, the media said, well, if you tried to book that kind of trip on your own, it would cost, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Okay, I get it. Why do you suppose it was that the Justice, Associate Justice Thomas didn't just say, fine, I'll report all this stuff, as the rules appear to now require, and if anybody thinks otherwise of it, fine. Because reporting it, disclosure seems to be another thing. Well, it is another thing that I believe in government for both sides.
No, the rules would require disclosure of all of that only since 2 months ago. The rules under which Justice Thomas has operated since 1991 have not required disclosure of what's called personal hospitality.
Right.
That is, things like transportation and lodging from close friends who do not have business before the court. And this is an example of what I was talking about a minute ago. Just a few years ago, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg took a trip to Israel, funded completely transportation, lodging, and food by a billionaire who had business before the court, and yet the left said nothing. Justice Thomas did not have to disclose those things. He complied with the law, and that should be enough.
Except they're going to, and now, is their plan, you think, to push Thomas out of the court, knowing that Joe Biden at this point would still get the pick of the next justice, and he'd put a screaming left-wing liberal on the court?
Well, we can thank the founders of our country who guaranteed that justices serve during good behavior, which is until they are impeached and removed from office. And, of course, quibbling with a justice whose decisions you don't like, but who has complied with the disclosure laws, is hardly an impeachable offense. They've been hounding him, trying to undermine and weaken his influence on the Supreme Court since he was appointed in 1991. This is nothing new. But again, I want people to see that this is part of a broader campaign to try to pressure and coerce the Supreme Court to rule differently in cases, because only those who, you know, rule in the, quote, conservative direction are targets of this campaign.
Yeah, so what do we do about this at this point? Because there's a drumbeat out there. I don't think they got anywhere. I mean, it's not as though Clarence Thomas is saying, okay, I'll consider stepping down. And he understands the consequences if he does. He changes the makeup of the court. And if they can knock off two of them, they change the makeup of the court potentially for another 40 or 50 years.
Well, this is a campaign to try to take over the court. We fight back. Anyone who believes in an independent, impartial judiciary, anyone who believes that politicians should not try to manipulate and coerce Supreme Court decisions, should object to all of this. The hearing that was held yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think, did a good job of exposing the one-sided, selectively ideological targeting of all of this. We have to fight back. We have to tell the truth. Justice Thomas did nothing wrong. The fact that his friend who supplied lodging and transportation happens to be rich is nothing. It's not a difference in the least. So I think we have to expect ethical standards from our justices, and when genuine ethical lapses occur, we need to address them. But Congress trying to impose an ethics code on another branch of government, which even liberal law professor Larry Tribe says is unconstitutional, is not the way to go.
No, because we have three separate branches. And if the Congress could muscle the Supreme Court on anything or threaten its members, they could actually have the influence. I mean, here they're purporting to say, well, gosh, if you got a free trip from your friend, you might be influenced to change your decision. Well, that's exactly what Congress is trying to do, is muscle them to change their decisions, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, just think of it. Politicians are suggesting that justices might change what they do because they have rich friends. Are you kidding me? I worked in the Senate for 15 years. You can't hit a dead cat, or you can't string a dead cat without hitting a politician who does that. The fact is that the three bills that have been introduced would reach into the judicial branch, into the Supreme Court, to try to dictate how it operates internally. You know, like I said, if you believe in the separation of powers, if you believe in the basic structure of our system of government that has preserved our liberty so well, we've got to reject this and we've got to expose it for what it is.
I agree. Tom, thank you very much. We always appreciate your insights.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. That's Tom Gipping, Deputy Director of the Ed Meese Center, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. I'd be glad to hear a naysayer on that one as well. At 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Let me tell you what's going on. First of all, our Twitter poll today. Should prosecutors investigate the alleged crimes by Oregon's Secretary of State or just move along? Because move along is what I think Governor Tina Kotek wants to do. She has handed the case of Shamia Fagan, who announced her resignation yesterday. She appeared to have been taking bribes. She appeared to have engaged in official misconduct. There were crimes that may have been committed. Should those be investigated? And if you say, well, the governor has said she's going to hand it to the attorney general. The attorney general has no legal authority to bring charges on those crimes. She can bring charges on election law crimes, but not on this. So it's Tina Kotek. I almost said Kate Brown. It's Tina Kotek's way of simply saying, I'm going to have somebody investigate the crimes who can't bring any criminal charges. So the two options I've given you, investigate and prosecute or move along. I'm going to go for investigate and prosecute. Today's Twitter poll, @LarsLarsonShow, is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your calls now. Let's start with Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, brother, I must say this. God bless you. Keep doing good work. Shamia Fagan, I believe that she committed, like you said, RICO and everything else. And I think our Senate that decided not to show up, they need to stay out. I think her, in my opinion, the Measure 113 she orchestrated while she was being given money through $10,000 a month. Man, I would take $5,000, brother, if I can have it. But nevertheless, the questionability of her taintedness of propriety, you know, her ethics, is wrong. And by her approving the final written of Measure 113 to violate my senator's or representative's right to protest will be the same thing if you went after the union saying unions, public unions can't protest or anything else if they want a pay raise or they want to stay out because they want to have the COVID situation set up to what they want. To me, it's a double standard. It violates the First Amendment of my representation. We, the people, should have the right to choose if they did what they didn't.
Yep. By the way, when somebody runs for a public office, if you ran for school board, for the city council, county commission, state legislature is still a largely a part-time job. She ran for a full-time job. She promised the voters, I will go down and do the job. She then neglected her duties and figured out a way to peddle influence out of her office, which is a longstanding tradition in Oregon. You had John Kitzhaber and his girlfriend who engaged in. You've had a lot of people who've been involved in this kind of thing. And it's spitting in the face of voters saying, you trusted me to be a leader and I've decided to sell my soul for some money. That needs to be prosecuted if they can show probable cause to believe she's committed crimes or a crime, she should be prosecuted for it. Ron, thanks for the call. Let's go to Lori. Hey, Lori, welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. So let me turn this speaker off.
No, well, thank you for that, because that makes it easier for everybody to listen. Go ahead.
Here we go. Okay. So I wanted to let you know, you were talking about fentanyl in the illegal drugs. Okay.
Yep.
I have a friend, a former pharmacist. She's retired. Her mother lives in a retirement village trailer park in Arizona. And she just found out that her mother ended up in the hospital because one of the drugs she was taking prescribed was tainted with fentanyl.
How did the drug get tainted with fentanyl?
Well,
do they have any idea?
Well, let me tell you. So she, come to find out, she goes down to Mexico to get her drugs.
Not smart.
To get her prescription because she can't afford it. And we're dealing with that. She doesn't have the right Social Security, you know, advantage or whatever. But anyway, we're dealing with that thing. But come to find out, there are factories in Mexico that American companies, Bayer and Myers and all these different companies, have their drugs processed down there. But what they don't know is, and this came from a nurse who had watched a seminar at the hospital in Parker, Arizona.
Yeah.
Okay. She said that they had a seminar and they found out that those same manufacturing plants process illegal drugs from the cartels under the cover, under the table.
Now, how do we know this? Hold on.
Well,
how do we know that?
It was in the seminar. That's all I know.
Okay.
Okay. And what they said was, in this seminar, they do not clean the machines after they're finished running fentanyl through them. They do not clean them. So the next batch of aspirin or Tylenol or whatever it is, whatever you were prescribed, blood thinner or whatever, that goes through their machines is not, it's tainted. And they're finding more and more, they're finding legal prescription drugs tainted with fentanyl. And it's an ongoing investigation. They aren't talking about it. You don't see it in the news, but it was important enough that there was a seminar to inform all the nurses and the doctors in this hospital in Parker, Arizona.
That's a big concern if we've got tainted drugs coming in, and I would hope the FDA could spare its time from pushing people to get the jab to go after that problem. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. Pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Our Twitter poll today, after the resignation of Oregon's Secretary of State, the number two job in the state. In fact, if the governor were to resign or leave office, the Secretary of State would take over. That's happened recently. But after Shamia Fagan's resignation yesterday, should prosecutors investigate the alleged crimes of Shamia Fagan or just move along? I would vote for investigate and, if appropriate, prosecute. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, when it comes to Washington State, I'll have to admit, I've never been a state lawmaker, don't aspire to be one, don't really understand how the legislature works. But it occurred to me that when the governor of the state, Jay Inslee, who thank God is leaving after this term, although replacing him with Bob Ferguson is a terrible idea, so let's hope that doesn't happen.
How is it that if the legislature meets for months and doesn't get something done, does it do any good to call them back in special session and say, come back and do what you didn't get done the last several months? I'm going to put that question to Senator Keith Wagner, who represents the 39th Senate Legislative District in Washington. And he is, in fact, a Republican, although we've encouraged Senator Wagner to bring a Democrat friend with him for the next interview. Senator Wagner, welcome back.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, Lars.
So if after several months, the Washington legislature has decided not to correct the massive error of the Washington Supreme Court and actually put some serious drug laws on the books so that we have, you know, we can stop stacking up the body bags of all the people who die either from illegal drugs or from the illegal drug sales activities that often involve the use of guns by gangs and drug sellers, is calling him back, calling you back in a special session going to achieve a different result?
Well, a lot of us would like to come back under special session and do a better job, but there's a time and a place to do that. And the governor has completely disregarded our leadership's guidance on that, which has been, don't call us back to a special session unless a deal has been rendered. And why is that important? Because as you said, we just spent 105 days, greater part of 4 months, and not gotten a deal. Now we have, bad coaching. Coach Inslee says, get back in there and try harder. That's not good coaching, and it's not good leadership. And he has been completely disengaged in the process. I haven't seen him do anything to help Blake, and I know what it's about because I was the prime negotiator for the Republicans on the Senate side when we sent a very good bipartisan bill over to the House, and the House Democrats messed it up to a point that they couldn't get the votes. So we know what needs to be done because we did it in the Senate. But if we're not back there, being called back to special session is a waste of time and a waste of taxpayer dollars.
Well, in fact, let me throw an idea. I know that you lawmakers usually write the laws. I mean, you do it with some legal counsel and others, but the governor could literally say, this is the thing I'd like to have in the law. He could make his own suggestion. Now, you're free to take it or not. He hasn't even done that, has he?
He hasn't, and I think that would actually be very useful if he looked at the process that I just described where we got bipartisan bill over to the House. If he just looked at that bill and put a little bit of his oomph and pressure on the House Democrats to pass that bill, we had four simple changes to the bill they brought to the floor. So everybody knows what work needs to be done. If he used his influence in a helpful way, I think it would be great, but I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, so I want to tell citizens, though, what's holding him back? And am I right in suspecting that Jay Inslee does not want to take a position against hard drugs? And he's avoiding it because he's happy to send you a proposed budget, right? He's happy to send you all kinds of other crazy ideas. But he says, don't make me take a position on hard drugs. I mean, for the life of me, I can't understand why anybody in government wouldn't say, this is killing people right and left in the state of Washington. It's bringing a lot of violence, not gun violence, because there is no such thing, but people violence to the state of Washington. Let's do something about it. And he's admitting by his inaction that he has absolutely no clue how to solve this.
Yeah, he's failed to take a position, and I think it's because of politics. People on the far left want to see complete decriminalization of drugs, but we're kind of in that boat right now, and we've seen the result. Thousands of people have died, but some people are still vested in that was the right move. I don't know what it takes in their logic to turn them around and realize, oh, we made a mistake. But most of us can see we made a mistake. A majority of us saw in the Senate that we made a mistake and we want to pull it back the other way. It would be very nice for the governor to weigh in with the same sentiment. We made a mistake. Let's fix it. Let's put some teeth into the program to help people get better and to make our communities safer.
I mean, Senator Wagner, I would confess I'm a bit of a libertarian. I want the government to stay out of my life.
But I'm also not enough of a libertarian to say, gee, I think I can imagine what society would look like if you could go to the local convenience store, 7-Eleven, and buy methamphetamine or fentanyl or heroin anytime you want. You know, there'd probably be people who'd stay away from it, just like there are people who stay away from booze. And there'd be other people who'd be in tremendous trouble very quickly because they'd try it, they'd get addicted to it, and then their life goes downhill along with everybody around them. Is that what your Democrat colleagues say is a desirable way for the society to operate?
Well, I don't think they'd put it in those terms, but you're absolutely right. We have a preview. We're living in it right now. Under the current law that passed, what, two sessions ago, that
yep.
says you get two strikes and then maybe we'll charge you with a misdemeanor, but nobody's counting the strikes. It's the same thing, and you've seen the result. Look all around us at the thousands of deaths, the crime that is related to drug use, the homelessness that's related to drug use. We see what's coming. We need to make a quick U-turn.
I just, you know, this is why I'd love to talk to some of your Democrat colleagues, Senator, because I'd love to ask them, what do you imagine a complete legalization of these hard drugs would do? I mean, other than dead bodies, more people homeless, families busted apart. I mean, because they say, well, you should be able to decide what goes in your body. It sounds good in theory, but I'm just trying to imagine. Just take one of those drugs like meth and say, what if everybody could buy meth anytime they wanted to? There might be people who might use it sensibly and occasionally, and there'd be a whole bunch of people who'd get hooked on it, never be able to get off, and would be doomed. And that also dooms everybody around them. So I hope you can scratch some kind of deal together. I'll give you the last 10 seconds.
Yeah, I just want to be fair to the Democrats who voted with us on the bill. They obviously understand how important it is to fix this. So it's a minority of people on the far left who seem to be running the show.
Unbelievable. That is Senator Keith Wagner from the 39th District. Senator, thanks very much. Coming up in a moment, New York State makes some real history, and not in a good way. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. How long is it going to be before every single liberal state in America simply bans the use of natural gas and propane? And what are the implications of doing that? Because the first big state in America, and it's a big one, New York State, has decided to do exactly that. Let me consider that in just a moment. First, if you'd like to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So, and if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, you can go there, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, of course, and LarsLarson.com on our website. We change the question every single day. It always keeps it interesting. But New York State has become the first state in America to ban natural gas stoves and fossil fuels in all new buildings starting in 2026. Now, they did limit it because apparently the laws of physics and other things have said that any new building that is shorter than seven stories, it has to be all electric. Now, why would they exclude the taller buildings? Probably because it's very, very difficult to arrange the physics to make it possible to supply those services above seven stories. So it sounds like the short buildings, where I would guess less affluent people end up living, you build a brand new one, you can't put a natural gas heater in it. You can't put a natural gas stove in it. You have to have all electric all the way or else. And why? They say that it's a major victory for the folks who are climate activists, and I'm sure that they would count it as a victory for climate activists. But the crazy thing about it is, I hope that it's going to be challenged in court. There are at least signs that it will be challenged in court. But the thing I've never understood, and I can't really wrap my head around this, is the idea that they're saying Americans are going to be banned from using one of the most popular across the country, and one of the most plentiful and one of the least expensive ways to both heat your house and cook your food and heat water as well. Three of the necessities that all of us take for granted right now. And if you say, well, gosh, doesn't that burn fossil fuels? Yes, it does. Do we have a lot of them? The numbers, and we've had people on the show before to talk about this, America is sitting on an ocean of natural gas. I mean, we have now proven reserves that total up to literally trillions of cubic feet of natural gas. Enough natural gas to last at least hundreds of years, maybe even longer. Because, as you may know, I mean, over the years when I've owned houses, I've usually, if they didn't already have a natural gas furnace in them, I put a natural gas furnace in there. And why? Because it's efficient, it's quick, and it's inexpensive. As for electric heat, I know some people who swear by electric heat. They love it. They say, well, you don't have any air blowing through from a forced air gas, FAG, forced air gas system. You say, no, you've got baseboard heaters or some other kind of electric heater. And they chew up electricity to beat the band. And there's a concern about this because it seems as though the folks who run this country and the folks who are calling the shots, and especially in those states that are the more liberal or blue states, the ones that hew to the Democrat line, they seem to want to put everything on electric. They want to make all houses all electric. They want to make all cars all electric. And the problem is America has a very tenuous electric grid right now. You've already seen times just in the last 2 or 3 years where entire states like California have said, we have to shut the grid down because of concern over forest fires, because of terrorism, because of cyber attack, or because there just flat isn't enough electricity. And if you say, but America's always had enough electricity, let me explain why the numbers make it really easy to see why we're going to run short. And we're going to run short of electricity even without this crazy jihad to push everybody to electric cars and electric water heat and electric space heat and electric cooking. Why are we going to run short? Because right now, over 50% of America's grid is supplied with electricity by fossil fuels. It is a combination of coal. Yes, we still burn coal, and we do it within all the environmental rules of the United States. But that's not good enough for the Greens. And you say, well, where do we get the rest of our power? We get a good percentage from nuclear. You say, well, that's a good place to get electricity. I agree with you. We ought to have more electric plants from nuclear. The problem is we've had one big electric plant down in America's southeast, I believe it's in Georgia, that has come online in the last decade or few decades, and there are almost no plants that are in line to be approved. And they take a long, long time to build because they're usually up against a whole bunch of opposition. Secondly, I've documented on this show, we've had guests on who know the regulations well, and they say the new regulations written by under the Biden administration have said you can have a nuclear plant if you can show that it is absolutely impossible to have any kind of industrial accident. Well, anybody out there who either follows the subject or works in industry say, you're promising that you can build a plant if you can prove that you'll never, ever have an accident. And I'd remind you, the history of nuclear power, most of the nuclear power plants that supply electricity right now were designed in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And they're very, very good. You've never had a single death in a commercial electric nuclear plant in American history. Not one. And people say, well, what about that plant in Idaho, the Inel plant? It was a research laboratory or a research nuclear reactor, not a commercial nuclear reactor. Well, what about Three Mile Island? Nobody died because of Three Mile Island. Was there an accident? Yes. Did some radioactive gas get released? Yes. And I know there are people who say, but if you do the calculations, you can figure out that the amount of radioactive gas that was released might have upped the incidence of cancer by a tiny, tiny amount. That's how they claim that they can show deaths. But have you had anybody actually killed because of a commercial nuclear electric plant accident? No. So at the same time that we're running short of electricity, we're a growing country. We have about 3 or 4 million kids who graduate from high school or college every year. They have to go somewhere. They have to live somewhere. They have to work somewhere. They have to heat water. They have to cook their food. They have to heat their homes. And now you've got states like New York that's proud to become the first state in America to say, but you can't do it with natural gas and propane. And there's a second issue, and I want to bring this up quickly. This is very much an anti-rural kind of regulation Because in the big cities, they might say, well, we've got Con Ed in New York. We've got plenty of electricity. The big cities will always make sure that they're well supplied. But what about people out in the suburbs or in the rural parts of America? What about the people where there is no natural gas and they say, but we have a perfectly good propane tank in our yard? Well, at this point, every brand new house under 7 stories tall. So in other words, they've protected their friends in the big cities in New York State by saying the ban applies to everybody as long as your building is shorter than 7 stories. If it's taller, like so many buildings in New York City are, because real estate is expensive, well, then you're exempt from the rule. Now, does that make any sense? But you folks out in farmland, tough luck for you. You are going to get screwed out of this. You won't be able to use natural gas if it's available. You won't be able to use any propane if it's available. You're going to have to heat with electricity. And they say, well, where's it going to come from? Oh, there's plenty of it. Don't worry about it. After they plan to wipe out 50% of America's electric grid, this move by New York State becoming the first in America to ban natural gas and all fossil fuels in most new buildings, it is absolutely going to destroy America. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Net. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. For more than 25 years, one of the recurring themes on this show is that America needs to have secure borders. And one of the biggest problems America has is literally millions and millions of illegal aliens. And before Joe Biden even came into office as president, we had, according to the Yale estimate, 22 to 30 million people in this country illegally. That's almost 10% of the population. And then Joe Biden comes in and makes previous invasions of America by illegals pale by comparison. The latest number, I'd been using 7 million, but I just heard from a member of Congress this last week. The number is closer to 9 million illegal entries to the United States by aliens over the last two and a quarter years under Joe Biden. And now we find out that some of those people are coming in because Joe Biden has paved the way for them by allowing them to commit immigration fraud as they enter the country illegally. We get the details from Todd Bensman, who's a senior national security fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. Todd, good to have you back on.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you mind explaining to my audience how this works? Because we do have, for people who are seeking succor, they're looking for a place to go and be safe from the persecution they've felt, and there are legitimate cases like that. But what about these Venezuelans who are coming into the United States, and how is it that they are gaming the system?
Well, Venezuelans are among the highest volume nationalities crossing that border. Just hundreds of thousands have crossed over the last 2.5 years. And I think the common narrative about them is, you know, Venezuela's got a kleptocracy, a dictatorship who, ruined the country and is really oppressing his people. And so all these poor Venezuelans, we've got to let them in and give them asylum or humanitarian parole or something to give them protection from Maduro. But the truth is that very few of these Venezuelans that you see on TV that are turning themselves in are coming from Venezuela. They have been living prosperously and often happily and certainly safely in third countries that are near Venezuela, but not in it, like, for example, Ecuador and Colombia. And I mean, for years, 6, 7, 8 years. And all of a sudden now, all of them want to come over the border. And when you really get down and interview with them, they tell you, the only reason I really want to come is because the border's open and I can get in. They're letting us in. They're letting us all in. All we have to do is say we're coming from Venezuela. That's asylum fraud. That means that at some point, all those thousands of people are going to have to claim on a government document and or to an agent of the federal government that they were persecuted. But when I talk to them, I've got this, lots of video interviews with them in my piece at CIS.org today, a 15-minute video about this. They're saying, yeah, I loved Ecuador. I'm going to miss it so much. A lot of them are very prosperous. They have all the latest fashions. They flew in. They are just simply upgrading because they can.
And because economically it's better. Todd, I think one of my problems with the immigration debate is there seem to be people who are afraid of saying, you're coming in because you want to get a better paying job. You want to live in a country that perhaps has better courts, better cops, better neighborhoods, better everything, and you'll make a whole lot more money here. Well, that's a nice aspiration. I want everybody to make more money legally. But I don't make money illegally, and I don't respect people who earn their income illegally. So if they say, well, I want to leave Ecuador. I was happy there. I wasn't being persecuted in Venezuela, even though I am Venezuelan. But I was in Ecuador. I wasn't being persecuted. But the paycheck is better in America. I'd like to come here. America doesn't grant immigration to this country simply based on economic need, does it?
It does not. And so all of these Venezuelans will be making a claim that they should be allowed in on humanitarian protection grounds, which is to say, I am fleeing imminent harm. I am fleeing death-defying danger. I am fleeing political persecution based on my race or religion. And that is the fraud. That is actually prosecutable fraud, felony fraud. You lie to immigration officers about that, put it on a document and sign your name on it, you're looking at up to 5 years in prison per count. And I would argue that the vast majority of the Venezuelans that you're seeing coming in under the Fox News drone or whatever the camera is that's catching the thousands of them turning themselves in, that they are all going to claim that if they haven't already. And I just wanted to point out in my piece that this is just a major fraud that's going on, being perpetrated against the American people, and nobody is calling them on it. The administration, if anything, is enabling and facilitating it by not even asking for any kind of evidence or proof. They're just taking you say you're coming from Venezuela, it must have been terrible. Come on in.
Yeah, and the thing is, this country has prosecuted immigration fraud before. I mean, I remember one case where 400 people who were actually very well-educated, very well-heeled, I didn't defend them doing this, but they got married to 400 other people, both men and women, and they perpetrated one of the largest immigration frauds in American history. And the federal government went to extraordinary lengths to prove that they had gamed the system. Even though you could say on paper, these are the kind of people we want, well-educated, well-heeled, self-supporting, etc. But you still don't get to game the system. Usually the punishment is not just the 5 years you mentioned, but isn't it also the case that if you perpetrate immigration fraud, immigration can literally say you aren't allowed to apply for American status again for at least a certain number of years or maybe never. Isn't that also the case? That's one of the punishments?
Yeah, all of those processes and laws and systems are in place. The problem is that this administration doesn't care about those laws and will not prosecute. You'll never see that happen under this administration. They are doing everything they can to not check you. You can see, I mean, I cite in the video report that just went up at CIS.org, this morning, like a Texas Monthly story that says, yeah, they don't even ask what your humanitarian parole is for. What was so terrible right now? You can do that later. Most of these folks are being granted something called, or hundreds of thousands, 350,000 Venezuelans that got in earlier were given temporary protected status, which gives them access to all, you know, public welfare and work authorization, and is probably going to be renewed for 50 years based on we can't send you back to Venezuela, but none of them were living in Venezuela. Even the TPS thing that we granted last year is based on a complete hoax. And I think somebody just needs to call it out. It's a hoax.
You know, it's funny.
And it's a
you've
mass
got the
hoax.
You've got the Biden administration hiring 87,000 new IRS agents to go out and look at every jot and tittle of every taxpayer's tax filing to make sure they can squeeze out a couple of $100 or a couple of $1,000 from those people saying, you better obey the law because you have to pay your taxes. And if we find that you've cheated, we may just send you to prison. We may just demand you pay more money. But illegal aliens, come in, lie to us all day long. We don't really care. That's Todd Bensman. You should take a look at the video at cis.org. It's a great organization. That's my only connection to it. I know they're a great source of information. Coming up, your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, where more than 23 years ago, we promised to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today about the resignation of Oregon's Secretary of State, the second highest ranking statewide elected official in the state of Oregon, the person who would step into the governor's job if the current governor somehow left the job for whatever reason. Shamia Fagan was elected to the job. She was in money trouble personally as she was running for the job. And I want you to think about that for just a moment, because there are two implications of that. Number one, if somebody can't manage their own finances, they can't pay their bills or won't pay their bills or make the sacrifices necessary to pay their bills. She was an attorney. She could have made good money. She decided she wanted to run for office. That's her decision. Then she goes to the voters and says, by the way, I'd like you to elect me to the number two job in the state. And I don't think it's any secret whatsoever that Shamia Fagan had great plans to run for governor of Oregon someday. I would say those plans are pretty much out the window right now or down the toilet because of her own graft, what I think was graft and corruption, selling pay to play, just like John Kitzhaber's girlfriend once did it in the governor's office, and he ended up resigning. He'd been elected to a historic fourth term in office. No other person has served four terms as Oregon governor. And you can only serve two terms, then you have to take a break, let somebody else be governor for at least one term, and you can run for two more. He had just taken the oath about 30 days before he was forced to resign in disgrace from the job because he allowed his girlfriend to peddle influence literally out of the governor's office. So now you got Shamia Fagan. Even with all of that as a warning, don't do this if you're not ready to do it. She ran for the job anyway. She knew the paycheck was not gigantic. The Secretary of State makes about $7,000 a month. And you say, well, that's not enough. That's a discussion for another day. As far as I'm concerned, I think politicians are paid plenty of money. And you know why I back that up? No matter how little the job pays, people run for the job. And I've always been glad that in both Oregon and Washington, we have a largely citizen legislature, although it's rapidly evolving into a bunch of professional politicians. And let me tell you why there's an advantage to having people who say, okay, I'll go serve a term or two in the legislature, but then I'm going to go back to my real life. There's an advantage to that. Because if somebody is serving as a member of Congress, as a member of the state legislature, as governor, as anything else, but they have a real existence apart from government, then they will make tougher decisions. If your entire paycheck depends on your profession and your career, your lifetime career is to be a politician for life, then you're going to make the kind of decisions that preserve your job. If, on the other hand, you're the man or woman who says, okay, I'll run for a couple of terms and I'll serve for a couple of terms, but then I got to get back to my real life somewhere else. That person, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, is better suited to serve you because they understand the challenges that you're up against. If, on the other hand, they're the person who says, hey, I'm a politician, and I'm going to stay here for life. I think one of the first things we could do is get rid of the pensions. I don't think any elected official at the state level nor at the federal level should earn a pension. You shouldn't be there long enough to accrue a pension. You should go, serve, represent people, make the tough decisions. And if one day a bill comes up before you and you have to make a vote, you say, if I vote for the thing that I think is the right way to represent my my constituents back at home. It's going to get me unelected. And your whole staff is saying, Senator, Representative, don't vote for that. It might cost you your job. You say, that's okay. I'll be doing the right thing, number one. Number two, when it costs me my seat in the legislature or in some other elected office, I can go back to my real life and my family and my community, and I'm better off there anyway. Do you know who also had that attitude? George Washington, the first president of the United States, because he didn't want to serve in Washington. He wanted to, they said, we need a president, we need a leader, you're the guy. He said, okay, I'll do it. But he wanted to get back to his farm in Virginia just as fast as he possibly could. He made plenty of money back there. He was a very successful farmer. He was also very successful in the fishing business, not him individually, but catching fish and, you know, putting them in big barrels and selling lots and making lots of money. He didn't have to have any graft or corruption. But then you've got Shamia Fagan, who gets to the job that she sought. She asked for the job. She asked the voters, elect me. She took the job. She then took $10,000 a month from a private company, LaMota, that is regulated by a state agency that Shamia Fagan oversees as the auditor of all state agencies. And she went worse. She was getting a big paycheck from LaMota, so she went to the OLCC, the regulatory agency, and said, sit down with this woman and listen to her and do some of the things that she's telling you to do. And what was this Caceres character doing? She told the OLCC, you shouldn't regulate me as much. And I think that's, this shows what graft and corruption buys. And I'm not surprised that yesterday, during a live interview on tape, or at least on tape, the owners of LaMota said, we didn't do anything wrong. We didn't do anything wrong, over and over again. Because you know what? I think they know in their heart of hearts they did do something wrong, and so did Shamia Fagan. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, no closing date. NickShivers.com for details. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.